1649 to St. George's Hill. A ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the lands in common and to make the waste grounds grow.
I'm your host, Kevin Annett. Welcome back to our second program in an unending series of reclaimed people reclaiming the land itself. You are listening to this 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, every Sunday here at Radio bbsradio.com/Radio Free Kanata. We have a number of guests today. We actually announced last week that we're going to focus today on one of the reasons for the Republic is the existence of genocide in Canada, the prosecution of those responsible in church and state, and why that has led to this new formation under a new common law jurisdiction called Kanata. We have with us today a number of Indigenous activists, including Peter Yellowquill from Manitoba and Joshua Lemens from the West Coast of Canada, so-called former Canada, now unceded common law territory of Kanata. And my apologies, we were to start off the show with a very important tape by a woman called Irene Fable. You can see her testimony at itccs.org. Irene Fable is a survivor of genocide at a Catholic Indian boarding school in Canada in 1944. She was describing how she saw a priest throw a newborn baby into a furnace live. And one of the examples of the many cases of atrocities that caused people to prosecute and find guilty Catholic, Anglican, and United churches in Canada for crimes against humanity. That's one of the reasons we're here today. We're going to talk about the legacy of genocide, how we can overcome it in a new formation, common law formation called Kanata, and how Indigenous people today are part of that, how they are establishing their own nations, which have never been destroyed. Both Peter and Joshua will be part of that process. We also have with us a number of friends. Ryan Gable, who's going to be co-hosting with me as well. I don't know if Ryan is on yet. I'll just ask these people to identify themselves after I stop. And Alexandra Madors, who's a good friend who works with through Galactic Connection website on the west coast of Turtle Island. And hi. Hopefully Katie Stokwa from the Algonquin Nation on the eastern shores, the eastern doorway. So why don't I just ask if any of those folks are on now just to let them introduce themselves.
Hi, Kevin. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and I'm very happy to be on this show today. Thank you for including me.
Quite welcome, sister.
And hi, Kevin. This is Katie Stokwa, and I'm happy to be here with you as well today.
Yeah, it's great. Are either the men on yet?
Yes, this is Joshua, if you can hear me. I am your Western representative here in British Columbia, or our territories present here. I'm the president for the Native Friendship Center in the Fraser Valley, as well a men's rights activist who represents the First Nations Men's Society, as well as the Urban Aboriginal Task Force on the West Coast.
And actually, Joshua and I actually go back a number of years. Joshua, I remember you were instrumental in actually helping convene the first tribunal into residential school crimes back in 1998, if that's right.
Back in 98, yeah.
It's been a long time.
Very, very crusty years, but, you know, I've outside of some of the questions that many of the elders have, which we'll go into, revealing this information has always been a very difficult thing when it comes to the dominant culture, news media, and everything else. Government-wise, it's almost an impossibility to, you know, deal with the reality of what's happening even now to our people.
Could you, you know, I know just remember that Peter Yellowquill is actually calling in at the quarter after the hour. So why don't we start, Joshua, with you talking a little bit about that. What it's been like, you know, I know we've done our own broadcasts about this, but countering this whole tide of propaganda that somehow, well, the issue of genocide is being resolved, the government made apologies, now things are fine again, we're trying to make things better. How do you as a Native person kind of respond to that?
Well, it's very difficult because a lot of programs that I'm asked to work with concerning the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, as well as the Truth and Reconciliation Society, which I partner with only because there are concerned elders and people who need a different point of view. It's very difficult because it's about... It's like the big Truth and Reconciliation party that they had that cost them $60-70 million, which never really goes to the communities. So we're trying to do things within the communities themselves, which is also a real problem because there are control mechanisms in place that really don't allow healing, per se. And we're trying to help the communities take responsibility for, you know, a process that isn't only about those who've gone through residential schooling, but those that are affected by the parents, the abuse that carry on to now two generations. And as the problems on and off reserve are becoming very, very extreme.
Well, I know we've had, even in the corporate media, they've reported a lot about simple fact, like over half the reservations in Manitoba and Ontario lack any kind of clean drinking water. The children are being raised in these ongoing intergenerational conditions of poverty and destruction. So are you guys on the ground? Can you give me some examples of some projects that could, lead towards more of a sense of people taking back their sovereignty and their land rather than relying on this colonial system? Like the Indian Affairs Department and that?
Well, for myself, dealing with territories on the West Coast is we're having a really big push of self-sustainability, sucking off of the colonial tit, as it were, is a real problem because the tribal councils or the chieftain council, they thrive on getting money to be able to help themselves and their families. And a lot of the time, there's nepotism that's it's a great problem. And my push for the traditional people and for those concerned is to create self-sustainability plans where they themselves, on their territories or their traditional territories, can create means by which they can have businesses and plans that will self-sustain themselves.
Why don't I ask, before Peter Yellowquill comes on, if Katie or Alexander have any questions, things they want to say about that?
Katie, you go first.
What was that?
I said, Katie, you go first.
Oh, sorry. There's just a little static on my end, Kevin. Can you?
You want me to repeat it? I was just asking if you wanted to comment or have any questions of Joshua about anything he said or anything you want to say.
Well, one of the things that I observe is when it comes to natives living on reserves and natives, the sustainability component is. I see a lot of the chiefs that are in the government's pocket per se, and so there's a lot of corruption right on the reserves. Any monies, any of the natives that I observe who try an effort to break out onto their own, often get stonewalled. And I wonder if you could speak to that.
Well,
Joshua?
Speaking as one of the directors for the Urban Aboriginal Task Force on the West Coast, one of the really big problems is I'm basically responsible for off-reserve natives. The big problem with that is that there's more natives, and we're not talking just about, for us, the coastal Salish, the interior Salish, the Haida Gwaii, Gitxsan, and the peoples of these territories. We're including the Cree, the Anishinaabe, and people that live here trying to either gain services or to have some kind of foothold, to have control over their own lives, as it were. There's a lot of transient population coming from on-reserve to off-reserve because of the problems that they're dealing with, drug situations or family feuds. There's a lot of, not that I would call it mismanagement, but a lot of political strife and problems on reserve that are forcing people out. And for them to get services is one of the things I'm working with groups like First Nations Health Authority, Fraser Health, and different governing bodies, as it were, to assist us. If you don't mind me mentioning this, we are working fairly closely with the Aboriginal housing contingent of the government to create a self-sustainability plan, and that's to build that our communities as a self-sustainability plan, so we can pay for drug and alcohol workers and homelessness workers that are working in conjunction with parties to create a business that can build tiny homes for different communities that are needed around the province, so that we can employ off-reserve people and employ our native community, as well as help the community at large.
You know, Joshua, it's interesting that you're mentioning that in Katie's question too, because that's one of the things Peter Yellowquill has been fighting for in a very determined way, and also getting the Manitoba chiefs to raise the whole thing of the fact of genocide, of the unreturned bodies of these children who died, the lack of prosecution of those responsible. Like, you know, if you're going to be treated like equals in a new nation, these things have to be addressed. They can't just be swept under the rug again. And so I hope, you know, we'll get into that more when Peter calls. Any thoughts, though? I know that you were, you know, part of that whole struggle for years to help uncover, you know, and just, you know, expose this whole residential school genocide.
Well, it's been a really big problem for me concerning partnering with some people call them truthers, and that is I've worked with you in partnership with the International Common Law Court of Justice, for instance, and with the Radio Warrior show that we used to have. It got so serious that the ISP, which means the Internet Service Provider, was being hacked. My computer had to be rebooted many times. I got threatening calls and things over my phone that created an impossibility for me to continue, as well as the Internet Service Provider that I had these websites on, and they were getting thousands and thousands of hits. Basically deleted my account because the ISP was being threatened. In other words, if he didn't do something about these sites, that his own servers were being threatened. In other words, it was either me or him.
So your experience, in other words, is that you were definitely targeted for bringing this information out.
Yeah, it's a given. And I know, you know, a lot of people with the pressures that they go under, for me, it's part and parcel of the work that we do. However, recently, I know that speaking to many elders and speaking to Mi'kmaq and some of the people back east, there's a huge concern. And it's something that when your other speaker comes on, that I'd love to talk about the issues of sovereignty, especially with the the natives' point of view concerning another neo-colonial body creating the question of sovereignty. So that would be a wonderful question.
Definitely.
To cover.
Peter, or Yellowquill is now on the line. Peter, can you hear me?
Yes.
Welcome,
yes,
Yellowquill.
Could you
welcome to the show, and maybe you could introduce yourself to the listeners, and we can get right into it.
Okay. Okay, I'm Anishinaabe Ojibwe. I'm also Lakota. Oyate, I'm also part Navajo. Now, that came about through different things. My Ojibwe name is Jean Inodin. I'm also, I was given some, I guess, some British or Hebrew names, Peter, Joseph, and Yellow Quill is the last name of my great-great-grandfather who was who entered into the treaty here at the fort, over Fort Garry in 1871. And that's kind of, I was 11 years in the residential school. Prior to that, I was about a year and a half, 2 years in the various sanitariums for tuberculosis, TB sanitariums.
Right.
And so...
you know, Peter, one of the things that really is burned in my memory is that day that you and I and others went to, I believe it was the former residential school where you had been incarcerated. Was it Brandon or was it near Portage, La Prairie? And you were standing there.
Brandon. I attended the Brandon. I attended the Brandon residential school and the one in Portage. But I was,
and I remember you standing at the door and you saying the children, some were sent to the right and some were sent to the left. And they were choosing you already for rape as soon as you walked in. Is that? I mean, these are. This is the harsh reality that people just don't want to look at often.
With the sexual abuse, I mean, that's the way it happened. I mean, you were like a little meat mess. And there was, you were helpless. It was hopeless to cry out. It was absolutely no one would lift a finger to help you. And that's the... a lot of people just kept silent about these things for years and years and years because for all that time, no one said anything.
And why was that?
I think the terror that was inflicted upon us. Like we've had examples of 2x4 spades, people being strapped 150 times. I mean, they're literally beaten numb, and so that kind of terror stays with you. And on top of that, there's the spiritual abuse, the mental abuse. It's all makes for a kind of a conditioning, almost like a brainwashing. Some of our people describe it as that, but I think it's comparable to the methods are the same as any places in the world where there's this type of oppression and this type of genocide. And we never learned what the word genocide really meant, because in our experiences, we felt, I think, isolated. And many of us came out with some real separation issues, separated from our family, separated from God, separated from a culture that was supposed to be teaching us our language and those traditional values, the spiritual values that make us who we are. Instead, we got replaced with some white Canadian scenario of what that culture was, like Leave It to Beaver and all that kind of crap. There was no real cultural teaching of any sort. Not even a true perspective on what Canadians were.
Yeah, good word.
Mm-hmm. Feel free, anyone on there, just to speak
to that, Peter, it's Katie here. You know, I do come across a lot of folk who don't understand the psychological trauma and the intentional brainwashing that a native experiences in these concentration camps. I think the residential, the term residential school is too kind of a word, because they were concentration camps is what they were. They were internment camps. And people tend to think, well, you know, like that if you're a survivor and now you're, you know, quote, freed from these camps, that the person is able to go out and seek help, get themselves into counseling, that kind of thing. And it really isn't that simple. the person is so traumatized and so disconnected from Creator, from our families, that it really is like they're digging themselves constantly out of a hole, and there's no help or very little, if any, help for people living on reservations. Like Joshua was saying, yes, it sounds like there are some programs in place for people who are living off of the reserves, but it's still quite a problem for those living on the reserves, and it's set up intentionally that way. The government sets that up intentionally, so they're really quite helpless and quite dependent on the system for assistance.
Yeah.
Well, that's how you're conditioned.
Yes.
You're conditioned not to think. You're conditioned to act and move in a certain manner at a certain time. And you're going through this your childhood without any real love.
Mm-hmm.
No.
I don't think I ever heard the word "I love you" in all that time. And not even when I got home. And the reason for that is my mother was in residence school. I didn't know that until later in life. So we've got this generational oppression and genocide, and it never leaves you. And I don't know if it's going to leave you in the next life either. That's the way I feel, because we buried these things for a long time, and it's even worse. Compounds, I guess, the pain, and it compounds the anger sometimes, and the disappointment and the hurt. When you really look at how the government handled this,
mm-hmm.
I was chief during the period that they were working to settle with the veterans, First Nations veterans, who, as we know, many people know, I don't know if Canadians know, but they were all volunteers. We were not obligated, because we entered into these treaties as sovereign nations, and we maintained that sovereignty. We did not have to fight any of Her Majesty's wars,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
but our men did. And the way they treated them was almost like a test run of what they were going to do to us.
Mm-hmm.
We occupied an Air Force base in the early 90s to press our case on land. And I was the chief at the time. We were working with our elders, the community. At that time, in 1990, we had met with the elders of our community, and there were three things that we had decided, that were elders from Swan Lake, Sandy Bay, and Long Plain. There were three things that we were going to address: the land, residential schools, and the Indian agent.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know the depth of the pain, though. I did not know how this was.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Canada wants to do is wants to forget all about it now. You've had your apology now.
Go away. Who wants you to forget about it? Sorry.
In my view, the federal government.
Canada.
Oh,
yeah.
I see. I didn't hear
the way
you.
I see
okay.
this. Is that, yeah, I'm kind of getting a buzz in there somewhere.
Yeah, go ahead. We can hear you.
Okay. So. When I heard the apology, right, my emotions were stirring up. I was almost like in a state of I guess my emotions were kind of running out of control almost. I was starting to cry almost, and then I heard Vive la Quebec Libre is what I say. I heard that French guy say, "Wait a minute. According to the Prime Minister, we're not yet human beings." And that, for me, blew it out of the water. And from there, I shut my emotions off like you shut off a tap.
Well, of course, when the government and the churches absolve themselves legally, as you point out all the time, Peter, they absolve themselves legally of any guilt for 50,000 deaths, you know?
Well, the thing is, I think the majority of survivors, and they're getting fewer every day, they know we've been burned. They just, and some of them are suspicious all along because how Canada conducts itself. For everything that we do as Anishinaabe, it's always like a sleazy, underhanded way of doing things with us. No honor in their conduct, despite the honor of the crown and all those sovereign things. But here,
Alexander,
an opportunity for Canada, the government of Canada, and the churches. You got to remember, they committed spiritual adultery. They got in the same bed and committed spiritual adultery. Mm-hmm. And what came out of it was genocide. The genocide was birthed by these two entities. Contrary to everything in the Canadian Constitution, contrary to everything that's in the Word of God, and it just literally led us to the slaughter. Gulags, concentration camps, you can call them anything you want. But to take a child forcefully, because we have living memories of men with yellow stripes on their legs, with dogs and guns, herding us into trucks and those types of things. So if anybody says that that's Christian, they're nuts. If anybody says that that's Canadian, I'll say they're crazy. I tell my neighbors whenever I can, you did not do this. We saw you working your land. You're keeping that treaty alive. But when it comes to government officials, that's where the guilt is. And the blood of all the children that were murdered, neglected to death, whatever, still stains the steps of the churches and parliament. That blood has not been washed away. That's because the Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, gave de facto immunity for the rapists and murderers of children. And I said that in Halifax in July to the chiefs. And I tried to get a resolution through to have Sinclair address the question of genocide as part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Circumstances didn't allow. But last week, at the meeting of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, Chief Ron Evans of Norway House, and another chief, another Cree chief, moved and seconded a motion to more or less direct the Honorable Judge Sinclair to answer a question of genocide. And I told the chiefs in Halifax, if Canada can dictate to a judge, okay, and handcuff that judge that he cannot address the genocide, then we can do the same and unhandcuff that judge if we can. But one way or the other, Sinclair has to give us an answer. The judge has to give us an answer. Mm. It doesn't matter if he's Peter, a judge. The judge is a judge.
Mm-hmm. Peter, that's leads into the whole thing of the common law and traditional tribal law and how that can be a weapon as well. But I wanted to just take a short break. And apparently, the technical staff tell us that they can play that little clip we have of Irene Fable. I'd like everyone to hear this right now.
People and how communities are starting the process of moving on.
I'm Irene Fable, I'm 75. I went to a residence and school in Muskogee in 1941 to 1949. And I had a very, very rough life. I was mistreated in every way. As a young girl, she was 7 years old. She was pregnant. And what they did, she had her baby. They took the baby, wrapped it up in a nice pink outfit, took it downstairs. I was in the kitchen with the nun for cooking supper. They took the baby into the, where they make a fire and all that to heat up the school, furnace room. They threw that little baby in there and burnt it alive. All you could hear was, that was it. And you could smell the flesh cooking. It's a big mistake when people say we were treated good. No way. There's a lot of things that happen in those boarding schools.
That's Irene Fable, a woman in her late 70s living in Saskatchewan, describing what she saw in the summer of 1944 at the Muskogean Catholic Indian School in central Saskatchewan. Now, it was interesting when that broadcast, and she was filmed at a Canadian Broadcasting Corporation town hall meeting in July 2008, just before the apology. It was on the CBC internet for about 24 hours and then was taken off and never put up again. We fortunately captured it. But, you know, Peter and Joshua, especially, I'd like you to just comment about this. This story is repeated countless times. And, you know, we face the fact that Canada has gotten away with mass murder and the world has allowed them to do it, although the witnesses are still alive and we still have the power of that truth on our side.
We have the power of truth, but don't fool yourself that Canada or the churches or any of the perpetrators are going to say, we're truly sorry, what can we do to help? I think that it's an impossibility. When I go and speak to places, especially concerning residential schooling, I usually start by telling a story of a priest coming into a white family, because a lot of the people that I speak to are newcomers, and I talk about a story of where a white a priest comes in and takes the children of a white family, decides that one of the three children are not really going to be good enough, and he takes a gun out and shoots them and takes the other two children, and then comes back several years and then forces the family to make an agreement that this perpetrator is doing really well, and that they are forced to accept the fact that even though their children were raped and murdered, that the perpetrator is doing a great job. That kind of psychopathy is so serious, and this is what's happening, but nobody seems to realize that even though the native people, when you consider the French, the English, even the people of Somalia that come here, the Asians, the East Indians, the native people are still at the bottom.
Yeah.
We're still recognized as the bottom of the bottom of the bottom. And don't think for one minute that the perpetrator is going to, because to them it means, well, that means we have to put out more money. That's one of the reasons why I think, Kevin, that you started the Canada thing. But, you know, a lot of us in the Native communities who are sovereign people really wonder, well, how does this apply to us? Because in a sense,
right,
it's seen as another colonial effort, even though you're trying to work with a lot of the communities. I know that my friends of the Mohawk Nation are in the sovereign area, are up in arms, making statements that are not always that nice. But, you know, what I do is recognize your heart and recognize the desire you have to be able to separate a people with a common heart and a common purpose against what's been happening here for hundreds of years. And this includes not only residential schooling and the slaughter of the native people, but also the taking of human rights and making everyone technically a slave race.
Well, you know, Joshua, I'm really glad you raised that, because the whole purpose of this forum is to get all this out in the open so it can be talked about and worked out. And just a reminder to people, Kanata is not an imposition. It's a movement among, for now, largely non-Indigenous settler Canadians to break away from the Crown, to establish their own sovereign identity. We've said from the beginning, it's not imposed on Native people. They can join or not join. But we have to work this out together under the Tuer Wampum original Treaty of Equality. So it's a process in the works, and I'm just very happy that all of you are participating. Peter, any comments?
Well, I think that what were we all expecting, Canadians and First Nations people? What was it that once Canadian people began to hear about these things? And even when our people began to talk about them after all these years, because I remember a case out with Kisi, Treaty 2 area, and there's a man there we had prayed with, and we talked about things. And after 50 years, he finally released and said, he saw his best friend being murdered at the Sandy Bay Catholic School.
Yeah.
After 50 years, he kept that in him. And I ran to one young chief who says, his grandmother told me about the same thing you were just talking about a young child being burnt, the fetus.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you it really gets me upset because we were seeking justice. Justice is sweet. It's almost like life-giving. And as this thing unfolded, all right, it became clear that this had nothing to do with justice. This had nothing to do with the churches saying they're sorry. If they were sorry, I'd say no, thank you. Same with the government of Canada. All it was a cost-saving measure.
Right.
That's all it was at the end of the day. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where were the churches? Where were the offenders? I don't think I saw any. The money
in Victoria. They had one in Victoria where the Catholic bishop got to stand up for half an hour and defend what they did in the residential schools, but survivors only got 10 minutes. I mean, the thing was disgusting, and that's why as a white Canadian, I will not be part of a society anymore that did that. I am not part of Canada or the Crown jurisdiction because morally and legally, I can't. No ethical person would be able to stomach this stuff.
Mm. Hey, Kevin, can I ask you a question?
But you see, even in 1990...
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just curious. I mean, anybody can answer this. It doesn't have to just be Kevin. But have there been any historical records or information brought forth of people that inserted themselves in these so-called centers and actually were able to infiltrate bringing this information out to the public anytime in the history of this whole thing going down?
Not officially, no.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
somebody
here.
Say something.
One of the things I noticed is, and I kept asking the question to myself, where were the good guys?
Yeah, me
too. They were there. And I remember clearly how some of them were so pissed off, they come and smash into walls, they hit. Because I believe they were trying to expose what was going on in that residential school. But they never lasted.
No,
where
that's
were the
right,
good
Peter.
Where were the good
they were
nuns?
Doing well.
Where were the good police officers?
They were driven out.
Where
Peter,
were
you know, we had a woman stand up, Marion McFarlane. She told that story at a forum we did in 1998 in Vancouver. I think you were there, Joshua, at the SFU Harbor Center. And she said, I reported a woman who was beating a little girl to death at the Alberni school, but I was the one who was fired because the woman beating the kid to death played the organ on Sunday and they had to keep her, so they got rid of me. You know, the humanitarian people are forced out of systems of genocide.
I'm just wondering why there wasn't more organization at all in being able to create some sort of, you know, double agent scenario where they could have gone in, worked within these institutions and churches and been able to expose them. I'm just surprised nothing like that was ever done.
Yeah, but who are you going to expose it to? It's the system
that's
running it.
True.
You know, it's like what we faced trying to bring this
out.
We're the enemy.
Good point.
Can I answer this question?
I saw the CRC.
Yeah, go ahead, Josh.
As a possibility. Sorry.
Go ahead, Peter. Finish, and then I'll make a statement.
Oh, go ahead, Josh.
Okay. We have a worldview dynamic thought. Go ahead.
You guys are being too Canadian, don't...
Yeah, we're very
polite. Go ahead.
And then we just stop talking. We have a worldview dynamic problem here. And it's something that we can look into in Germany with the camps that were there. We can look at apartheid in South Africa. We can look at many things that have happened generationally against different groups. For instance, now it's the Arab race, the Muslim race. There is a general consensus within people that through the worldview paradigm or the worldview that gets instilled via propaganda. Now, the big problem concerning this paradigm or this thinking is that people will look the other way. Some good people will stand up, but they are never really truly a part of the system. They have to be outside of the system to be able to institute programs or a fight or revolt. It's not possible to be within the system because you're going to lose your job or you get pressured or you end up in jail or you know, so on and so forth. One of the reasons why, for instance, that all Native communities across Canada, and if you're looking into the history in the last 10 years, where Child and Protective Services go right into the reserve and take the children, the RCMP freely going into the reserve, where before there was more of a border thinking or a sovereign nation. Back in the 70s, the Canadian government still in a lot of ways considered Native nations as sovereign. And now things are changing where they're being stomped on. Here in British Columbia, the Department of Fisheries, the DFO, comes in at any time to stop somebody from fishing his traditional territories. So there's a lot of things happening where the band councils are being paid off and pressured to allow anything to happen, which is weakening, in a sense, our people and the strength and resolve we have as a sovereign. However, some things are happening within the political scene that the government and people within the government know that the corporate entities that control the strings and the purse strings of what's happening in Canada are stating, for instance, when the Vancouver mayor was reelected, he first of all thanked the Burrard and the different nations in those territories as being a sovereign, and that he was thank you for, you know, allowing me to again be a mayor in your territory. I know that because of what's happening and what's coming, the Native communities have to start to be aware of their traditional territories and stand as sovereigns on it, because the Canadian government realizes a lot of their territories under corporate control are going to be swept away from them. So what are we prepared to do?
That's the question. That's the main question for this program. I should point out to people, we've got about 10 minutes left on the show, and we have only an hour every week, which is frustrating, so I want to actually make a point of inviting all of you back next week so we can carry on this conversation. Anybody want to make comments?
I just wanted to say one more thing, and that is you are all clearly taking on a very ambitious project to bring all this information forward. What are each of you at least thinking in terms of preventing the intrusion of moles and people that act like they want to be part of this, you know, expose, when in fact they're really working as a double agent for the institutions, church and state?
Hmm. I've had a lot of experience with that.
if you don't mind, I know I've been taking some of the time, but I'm going to answer it very quickly. There's something within their native traditions that has gone back thousands of years that we're instituting today, and we're calling it a modern name, but we're calling it SpiritNet. What SpiritNet does is it connects to the collective unconscious. It connects to the Creator. It connects to Mother Earth. And when you see somebody, when you talk to somebody, and it's something we practice all the time, because here in British Columbia, in the work that I do, we're on the forefront in a battle zone continually with all kinds of actions against us. But what we do is when we see somebody, when we talk to somebody, we not only talk to the facade that they've created, but we go into their being, we go into their heart, and it's an automatic, very quick thing that we just know. Collectively, when we're together, it was our job to know as Indigenous people. And this spirit net is something that connects us all, and it's something that we should allow ourselves to live in. You know, a Christian may say it's the Holy Spirit. A Muslim might say it's Allah. But as a Native people, we were always a very strong, intuitive people that had a childlike nature which reached and touched the hand of the Creator, that reached and touched the hand of Mother Earth, that guided us and allowed our thoughts to be clear. Thank you.
Right on. And that's probably the core reason why you were so targeted in the first place, right? Because you were so connected with Mother Earth and Creator.
Yellow Quill, do you want to comment on that? Peter, are you there? Oh, maybe he's off. That's unfortunate.
Hello?
I don't know if you heard any of that. Are you there?
There?
Peter, are you there? Yeah. Do you feel like commenting on anything?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I would just...
Go ahead.
Can you still hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hello? Okay. As people were talking, I was thinking, you know, we were those places on the hill, out of sight from the Canadian public. I think about the civil servants that saw these things and reacted and tried to do something. Where could they go? But the TRC represented at least an opportunity for them to come out if they wanted to. But I think they would have been so pissed off, you know, they would have been so hurt by what they saw, they want nothing to do with it, they wash their hands of it, and frustrated that their own government would do such a thing.
Right.
As Anishinaabe, we still, even though we were crushed, okay, but you can't crush a spirit. You can crush a culture. You could downpress them. You could do everything, but you can't crush the spirit of that man or that woman. It will always rebound. It'll always surface back. And our spiritual principles demand that we. Christian principles, the same thing. They demand that you speak out about these matters. Okay? Just because someone says they're a Christian, you gotta be able to discern what they're doing, and is it in spirit and in truth what we are about, and what are we supposed to promise keep? We're trying to reinstitute promise keepers in our area. Not only for purpose of feeding, but to record these things. And because our children still don't know what really happened, and they must know. And the apology is more like a slap in the face. After we found out what the churches and the state were really doing, and the Department of Justice and their lawyers, it was really ended up to be a slap in the face. And I don't think I've heard one survivor say yet that they've accepted. Like, I told the chiefs in Halifax, I do not accept an apology, not after I learned how they legally abused us, let's put it that way.
We got about 4 minutes. Why don't I just mention to people, if you're looking for background or resources on this, we have over 150 exhibits posted of hard evidence of genocide in Canada, the letters describing the 50% plus death rate, all of that material, statements, including from Peter Yellowquill and other survivors, up online. Go to itccs.org and hiddennolonger.com, also the canadarepublic.ca site. And like I say, I'm inviting all of you to come back next week. We can carry on this discussion and talking about alternatives. What are the things people are doing now to create some openings for people to move past, if that's possible, to move past the genocidal legacy? Let me give everybody just another 30 seconds to say wrap up, and we'll close off. Joshua.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our next time. We're waiting for a response probably from Beth Sinclair and see where that is going. And also we're working just on the ground trying to let our neighbors know that the thing is not forgotten. It's not over, unfortunately.
That's right. Joshua, any words?
I just want to say our battle is just beginning, because whether or not you accept the system of the Canadian government or not, they exist, and we have to deal with them. We are doing our work as human beings, as real human beings, and we know that universally, when we send out the, lack of a better word, prayers or vibrations of our positive attitude towards change for our people, our children, and our families today, that which we send out will come back to us, and that's why I believe what we're doing is going to affect, you know, change for our generations. The only other comment I would like to make is, how can people listen to the program afterwards? Is there a site or something that we can go to?
bbsradio.com/radiofreekanata. Programs are all listed there. bbsradio.com/radiofreekanata. Katie, you've got about 30 seconds.
I don't really have anything to add, Kev. Like, I look forward to actually carrying on this conversation next week. Peter Yeliquil, it was a thrill to hear your voice again, and I look forward to having continuing this conversation next week.
Okay, and I want to thank all of the participants today, all those listening in. Spread the word about Radio Free Canada. This is your program. We'll be back again next Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time here on Turtle Island. I want to thank you all.
Thank you.
One last comment, if I could, Kevin.
Yes, go ahead.
Kevin.
Yeah.
I'm going to say one last thing, and we've talked about this with some of the chiefs. We can't wash the blood off our own hands. Okay?
Right.
If we're silent about this thing, then that blood is splashing on our hands. We can't be silent. We have to carry on. And that's all I've got to say for today.
That's exactly it. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, Kevin, for all your work, and thank you, Peter and Joshua and Katie.
Thanks, Alexandra. Thanks for coming on.
Much appreciated, and I'm honored to be here.
Thank you, and we'll close on our song and see you all in 1 week.